Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello. Welcome to the very first podcast of the Commentary Track. I'm your genial host, Frank Thompson. It's a really exciting day for me. I've been working up to this for a long time, and I can't help but be struck by the irony that when I'm recording this, I'm all alone in my tiny office, only my lazy dog, Maggie, sleeping at my feet. And only a week later, you're listening to this, and because you're listening to it using the simple laws of statistics, I can only assume that about 20 million people worldwide are listening to it. I can't see any other way around it. So, I mean, that's bigger than the last episode of MASH. So, thank you very much for helping me become a record setter from the very first seconds of my podcast. I can't imagine what next week will bring when I actually have a guest. That's probably going to actually blow out my bandwidth. So, very possible you'll try to get next week's and you'll just get some sort of error message and then the entire internet will shut down. Hoping that will not happen. I've got some exciting things coming up in the weeks and months ahead. But let me start this one with some thank yous, some well-deserved thank yous. First, to my friend Gary Rand and to his friend, and I hope my friend someday, I've never met him, Rob Clearfield, who wrote my theme music. You'll hear that theme music at the beginning every week, and then I'll be trading off two different ending themes at the end of shows. They wrote two for me, one an extended version of the one that you just heard, and then one a more introspective, nay, Copland-esque version, which is quite beautiful, and I'm incredibly grateful to them for giving me this beautiful original music for my podcast. I've known Gary since we were both polywogs way back. We met when we were in our early 20s. We've been in a lot of bands together. We've made a lot of music together. He was a music director at a church in South Park Church in Park Ridge, Illinois. And I went out, helped him make some music there. I was in his band. We've done a lot of acts together, written music together. I've written songs with his wife, Lenora, and he even recorded one of them, which someday I might even put on the website so you can hear it. It's a song I'm very proud of and beautiful lyrics by Lenora. Rob is a musician that Gary knows in Chicago, where he still lives, and they have worked together a lot, and they are actually going to be collaborating on the music for my upcoming documentary, The Lost Remake of Beau Geste. I'll tell you more about that a little bit later. Thanks also to the beautiful, stunning, wonderful, my trophy wife, Claire McCullough, for being my Ed McMahon on this show and introducing me. I figured, how could I get the show started better than with her dulcet tones? Thanks to Gary Piper, who is a guy who answered my pleas for help when I just ran into all sorts of brick walls in figuring out how to get this thing not only recorded, but mixed and ready to get up on the internet and iTunes and on my website and so forth. And he came in and did two sessions with me and showed me the ropes about things that I just could not figure out in my own dense brain, and I'm most grateful. And finally, thanks to James Hutchins, who designed my website, thecommentarytrack.com, and we'll talk more about that in a little bit. First of all, you're probably asking, what is the Commentary Track? Well, first of all, let me say, hold your questions to the end. I don't have time to address all of these raised hands. Please, give me a break. I'm just starting out here. The Commentary Track is a podcast about film history, about classic films, as you might put it. Some might say about old films. I don't like the term. I wouldn't call Beethoven old music. I would just call it music. And the movies that I spent a lot of my life studying and enjoying and loving and talking to others about tend to be in what we put in the classic films category. It kind of annoys me, but I can't introduce a new term here. I don't know how I would do that. So I guess we'll just have to deal with what we've got. Always had an interest in classic films. Always had an interest in movies in general. I like movies that are made today. I'm not a snob about the thing. I don't think old movies are better than new movies. And I just happen to have a certain fascination for the silent era, especially the early sound era, and really everything in between. I have written a lot of books on film history subjects, on film directors, and on various aspects of film history. And some of them go way back. My book, The Star Film Ranch, Texas First Picture Show, is about the first movie studio in Texas, the Star Film Ranch, which was headed by Gaston Méliès, the brother of Georges Méliès. And they were in San Antonio in 1910 and 1911. That is a period that I love a lot. And the whole Nickelodeon era is very special to me, and I love watching those films. And on the other end of the silent spectrum, we just went to Oakland a few weeks ago to see Kevin Brownlow's incredible, magnificent restoration of Napoleon, the Abel Gance film from 1927, which I can say without fear of contradiction, because who's going to contradict my own opinion? But I don't think it's an opinion I'm going to change for forever, that it was the single most impressive movie-going experience of my life to see that film. And I've seen a lot of great films, and I've been very impressed by a lot of great films, new and old. But that one is going to be hard to beat, let me tell you. Let me talk a little bit about what this podcast is going to be and what it's not going to be. First, it's not going to be movie reviews. I don't like movie reviews. Movie reviews tend to make me angry. I'm not going to go into that. I know a lot of people read reviews. I'm not going to insult you for doing that. You do what you want to do. I'm not here to step on your toes. I just don't like it. I don't like going into a movie with somebody else's opinion already in my head. I love to be surprised. Nothing better for me than to be at a film festival or something where there's a whole roster of films about which I know nothing. And I'll just sit there, and when the curtain opens, I don't know what's coming at me. And that is great fun. People, for some reason, seem to think their time is too valuable than to sit through a film that they wouldn't like otherwise. And so they want to be assured before they go to it that it's going to be something that they're going to like. Not me. I like to be surprised. I like to have something open up to me, and so that's I'm not going to be reviewing movies. Now, that being said, certainly I'm talking with people about films in this thing, and we're going to be expressing opinions to one extent or another, but I hope that nothing that I ever say will ever keep you from seeing a film. That would break my heart if that were the case. Many films that I've liked over the years are films that I subsequently found out had gotten really bad reviews or that had not been liked. And I feel really bad at thinking that maybe I would have ignored those films or just not gone to see them in the first place if somebody had warned me off of them, and films that I like very much on my own terms. And I would never want to do that to anybody else, to warn you off something that might speak to you personally or speak to you in some way that maybe it wouldn't speak to anybody else. I don't know where we got this obsession with only liking films that are popular with other people. This is insane. It's just a stupid point of view. I blame Entertainment Tonight, but this whole thing of everybody knowing what the grosses of the film is and everything. Stop reading that stuff. It's insane. It's stupid. Just go see films and be surprised by films and discover something on your own. I remember a few years ago, we went to a screening of a Kevin Costner film called The Postman. I believe that's the name of it. I've never seen it since. And I was completely nonplussed by this film. And to this day, I can't tell you if it was the greatest film I ever saw or the worst film I ever saw. It was just unlike any other film I'd ever seen. And I never knew where it was going. It always went in some strange direction. And I'm delighted that I saw this film. It might be that if I saw it again, I could come around to thinking that it was really, truly horrible. Or maybe I would come around to thinking that it was a genuine masterpiece. Who knows? It's just never come up. Never seen it again. But all I do know is that later on, a lot of people started bad-mouthing it to me. And so I know how easy it would have been if I listened to that kind of thing beforehand for me to just have not gone to it. And in that case, have just missed what I consider an interesting experience. Maybe bad, maybe good. I still am not quite sure. And a lot of films like that. I can think of many, many more, and there's no reason to take up the time here in talking about them. In conversations yet to come on this podcast, a lot of this stuff will come up. And because it's me and because I do have certain deep obsessions and interests that I continually go back to, you will hear me talking about similar things with several different people. Can't help it. It's just the price you have to pay for listening to me talk every week. It's also not going to be an exercise in nostalgia. I go every year to a terrific film conference or convention called CineCon. It's held in Hollywood every year. It used to be held in different cities year by year, but for the past several years it's been in Hollywood, primarily at the Egyptian Theater. And it's a wonderful lineup of things, and I consider myself pretty knowledgeable on the subject of film history, and there's always a bunch of movies there that I have never even heard of, much less not seen. And so it's wonderful to see these things. But I run into a lot of people at that particular event and other, I would say, classic movie events that I attend from time to time who tend to live in the past and who tend to think, oh, they don't make them like this anymore, and why do the movies today have to be this and that when in the past they were this and that? This podcast is not going to be that kind of stuff. As I said before, I like movies today, and I go to new films all the time, and every once in a while we'll find something truly great, and often find films that are very enjoyable. And so I don't believe in that sort of thing. I don't believe that movies were better at any given time. I do believe that they were better at some things, and we'll be talking about those as well. But it's not going to be a good old days sort of podcast. I don't believe in that sort of thing myself. And so far, and I've interviewed about a dozen, 15 people that will be upcoming in these next weeks. And I haven't yet come across anybody in those who believe in that way of thinking either. So I think I just don't tend to hang with them. And not to saying I won't, because it's possible that it's going to come up. But I don't think I'm going to talk to too many people who believe in the, oh, those were the days when movies were movies and today it's nothing but trash. I don't believe that. But here's what it is. It's going to be conversations with film historians, with film archivists, with people involved in film preservation, with filmmakers, with actors. But in the latter case, filmmakers and actors, I don't want to talk to somebody who just wants to talk about their latest film. I want to talk to people who really have a sense of film history and who have had it inform their own work in some way or another. There are several directors who I am currently angling to get interviews with, and I bet if you think about it, you can guess who they are. And there are already a couple of actors who have agreed to do my podcast who have great knowledge and affection for film history, and in some cases have written books on film history subjects. And so I like that. I like people who are working today who have a sense of the whole history of the medium, and who knows what has come before, and who knows what was good and what was bad, and who the great directors were. And so that's the kind of people we'll be talking about. Now, I said I've already interviewed a whole bunch of people, and here's some of them. I interviewed Kevin Brownlow, the god of film history, I guess. The great composer and conductor Carl Davis, who conducted his score for Napoleon in Oakland, and that's where I interviewed him, even as we were being besieged by Mary Kay saleswomen all dressed in pink and shrieking at the top of their lungs in the hallways outside of our room where we were trying to do the interview. I've already interviewed the great Rudy Belmer. As a matter of fact, I interviewed him at such length that that one is going to have to be a two-parter. And the same can be said for my interview with Randy Skretvedt, who is one of the world's leading authorities on Laurel and Hardy, and also a real expert on period music, music from the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and and movies in general. We had a great long conversation, and we could have kept going for at least that much longer, except that I really had to go to the bathroom. So we finally stopped after about 3 hours, and so I'm going to break that one up into a two-parter as well, and I think you're going to find that interesting. I've interviewed John Bengtson. If you haven't seen his books on film locations, he's done three so far on the locations in the movies of Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, and Charles Chaplin, and these things are remarkable. He really has an incredible eye for where these movies were made, for finding obscure locations, for finding locations that show up in various films, not only by the same artist, but by different artists. Probably 10 or 12 years ago, I was in Iola, Kansas for the Buster Keaton Festival, and my friend Kevin Brownlow was there as well, and we were out in the lobby between screenings, and that was my first introduction to John Bengtson. He walked up and he had the page proofs to his first book, which was on Buster Keaton film locations. And from the first glance at that book, I knew that I had to have it. And indeed, the very day that it came available, I bought a copy and have bought all of his books subsequently. And it was terrific talking with him. And in fact, the day after I interviewed John, I did my interview with Kevin Brownlow in San Francisco, excuse me, and we spent much of the afternoon together with my wife Claire, and we had a great film history conversation, and really enjoyable. I've also got it. The first interview I did was with my great friend Tom Holland, who is a producer and film distributor, who's built up this interesting company called Holland Releasing that distributes classic films to theaters. So he has 35mm prints of films, and he's also developed some programs, one for Christmas and one for Halloween called Spooktacular, and it'll be a feature film and then other shorts and cartoons and trailers and things like that, and he's got a couple more of those coming up. I've known Tom with Gary Rand, since we were in our 20s, and when we both lived in Atlanta, Georgia, and he's one of my closest friends in the world, and we had a great talk. Also upcoming is an interview with Patricia King Hansen, who is the longtime editor of the AFI catalog, which, if you're anything like me, and I hope you're only kind of like me in some ways, these catalogs were treasures of film information, and now they're online, they're being updated, and they are still treasures. She's no longer the editor. My friend Bob Burchard is now the editor of this incredible project, but Pat Hansen still writes for the AFI catalog and does other kinds of work and is incredibly knowledgeable on film history, and we had a great talk. Also, my friend Joe Musso, who as an art director, conceptual artist, has worked with Alfred Hitchcock, worked for years with Irwin Allen on all those all-star films. So he has great stories to tell, not only about the filmmakers he's worked with, but also the many, many actors who came, especially through those Irwin Allen pictures, because if you remember Towering Inferno and all those things, they were just star-studded. And so Joe really got to work with pretty much every great actor who was alive at the time. They just all came through that Irwin Allen mill. And I've also done an interview with Marilyn Moss, who is the biographer of Raoul Walsh and George Stevens. And we had a great conversation. Raoul Walsh is, of course, as a director, right up my alley. And so this was a great deal of fun for me. And so I have other interviews already lined up. I have a couple more for this week. I've been doing a little bit of stockpiling, getting ready for this podcast to launch, because we've had several delays. So it's really fun for me to have already some of the greatest, most prominent film historians really in the world. And I've arranged already to meet with some of the others on my list. I'm hoping by the time this is over with, whenever that is, I'm going to have talked with just about every living film historian of note. And it's going to be a lot of interesting talk, at least kind of talk that I find interesting, and I hope that you will too. I told you about the website, thecommentarytrack.com. That's a place that I hope that you will visit regularly. For one thing, you can download this podcast from there, in addition, of course, to downloading it from iTunes. But go to the podcast website as often as possible, because I'm really connecting it to the podcast in many ways. One of them is that every time I have a guest on, I will have links to that guest works on my website. So let's say, for instance, Kevin Brownlow. When he is on, you'll then check the website, thecommentarytrack.com, and there will be links to Amazon for all of Kevin's books, for as many of the DVD and Blu-ray projects that he has worked on that are available commercially, and anything else related to his work, and sometimes even films that we've talked about at some length within the course of the podcast, which might not be a work of his necessarily, but is something that we talked about at some length, and you might want to see it. Well, there'll be links to all of those things through Amazon. And if you go to Amazon through my site, if you click on these things through my site, then I'll get a little kickback from Amazon, and it will help me get a little bit of income, and it won't cost you anything extra. There's no additional charge for you. You'll just be paying what you would have paid if you'd gone to Amazon through any other way. But if you go through my site, then I'll get a little bit of kickback. And if we get enough of these things going, then I might actually make enough to keep from going broke on this thing, which is a consummation devoutly to be wished. My own books, of course, will also be on the website. And those will be available in a couple of different ways. I do have hardcover and paperback copies of some of my books. I've published about 40 books so far. And I do have copies of some of them, so that if you would like to order copies directly from me and get them autographed to you or to whoever you might want to give it to, then you can do that. I'll have a link with a PayPal link, and you can just order it directly from me, and I will send it directly to you, having defaced it with my own name. For the books that I don't have extra copies of, for the time being, there will be Amazon links, and so you can go there and buy them from Amazon, and as with the other books, I will get a little bit of Amazon love from those things, and that would be nice. Eventually, I'm going to start putting up ebook versions of my books on the site. Those will be available at a nominal fee, and for those of you with Kindles or other ebook readers, that'll be a nice way to go from that. I'm also going to start doing some original books that will be available probably in all formats. I know the first one is going to be a book that my friend John Andrew Gallagher and I have been working on for years. It's our ultimate book on director William A. Wellman. It's called Nothing Sacred, The Cinema of William A. Wellman. And we are going to offer that in a variety of formats. One will be a gargantuan, lavishly illustrated book. This book is going to be huge. Not a coffee table book, but a refrigerator book. This thing is going to be hard to even get it in your front door. And it will also be insanely expensive. So we expect only 3 to 5 people worldwide will buy that. We'll also have it available in a hardcover and paperback copy for with much fewer illustrations and probably only in black and white. Much more affordable for those who just want the info, and that itself will be formidable. This thing is nearly 200,000 words. Really, everything we know about Wellman is in here. I mean, everything. And we'll also eventually offer that as an ebook as well. And have a couple of other book projects that are in various stages of completion that will go the same route. Probably not with the insanely illustrated gargantuan version, but in doing pretty much a publish-on-demand and ebook version of those. And so those, if you keep checking the site, we'll be making announcements on all of those things as they come up. We'll also be having what this podcast is named after, commentary tracks. That's actually what I first started to do with this site. I've done a lot of commentary tracks for DVDs, and as those have become fewer and fewer over the last couple of years, I started thinking there are lots and lots of movies that would be great to have commentary tracks for, but the studios aren't going to bother to do that with, or maybe they're already out and nobody's ever going to do another edition with the commentary track. So it occurred to me just to do them myself and offer them as audio downloads, and that way you can watch the film on your own through your own DVD or your own streaming video or whatever you do, or even record it off TCM or anything, and then just play my audio download with it. And it'll be me and other film historians and other people connected with those films in some ways. And that was going to be what I was going to do, and offer those for sale every week. And then it occurred to me one day what an insane idea that was, to try to do that many of those things on a regular basis, because doing a commentary track is a pretty big amount of work if you put any time into actually researching it and then all the recording and all that stuff. It's time-consuming, and it's hard, and it takes a great deal of expertise. And so it's just crazy to try to do one of those every week. But I am going to be doing them on a fairly regular basis. So those will be coming up in the pretty near future. And I've already decided which is going to be the first one. And if you know me at all, you can pretty much guess what that film is going to be. But if you don't know me, sooner or later you'll be listening to this and you'll figure out what it is. I'm not going to announce that quite yet, though. And also something that's going to come up on the website sooner than later is a documentary that I'm currently in what I hope is the final stages for. It's called The Lost Remake of Beaugest. And it's a documentary about a 1939 parody of William Wellman's Beaugest that was made by a group of San Diego State University students when they discovered that the fort built for the Wellman version was still standing out in the desert near Yuma, Arizona, And it occurred to them that it would be great fun to go out there and live in the fort and make a parody of the film. So they did. They didn't count on the fact that Paramount would not be amused by this situation and would come after them and threaten them and make them promise to destroy the print of the film. I found three survivors of that production. All of them are in their 90s now, and they're all three great and articulate guys, and it was great fun to get to know them. And so I interviewed them all and have been working on this documentary. When it's done, which should be by the middle of this summer, I will start offering DVD of the documentary and of the film itself, the parody that they made, all in the same DVD, and offer that from the site. So you'll certainly be hearing more about this as time goes on, because right now I'm not thinking about much anything else except that, because I'm working on it in pretty much all of my waking hours when I'm not at my job. So that's going to be a great deal of fun. This is also a very personal project to me, and it goes back to how I started getting interested in films in the first place. And that goes back to when I was about 12 years old. I was watching TV one afternoon. Well, let me backtrack a little bit. This is, I think, talking about movies in this way is going to be my generation's version of how we had to walk through 6 feet of snow over 10 miles just to get to school. Because I grew up in the days before video, home video anyway. And so we only got to see movies by serendipity. We only got to see new movies in theaters. Very occasionally you'd get a revival of some big film. But I lived in a little town in South Carolina, and there was certainly no revival theater, nothing like it in any way. So if it didn't show up on TV, there was no way in the world to see it. And so you only got to see what happened to appear out of nowhere. In those days, although, you know, we only had three or four channels on our televisions, and there was a lot of locally produced programming, and even for the networks, say NBC, there would be plenty of NBC shows, of course, but there would also be plenty of time during the day and late at night that was just controlled by the local channels. And so they would try to maximize that time with movies. And that's where you'd get, I know in some of the big cities like Los Angeles and New York, you'd have $1 million movie where they'd show the same movie every day for the entire week. But we had shock theater, which I'm sure was pretty much everywhere as well. So on a Friday or Saturday night, say 11 o'clock or 11:30, they'd show a horror film under the shock theater banner. And on Sunday afternoons, there was a program called Battleground, and it was just a showcase for war pictures, usually from the 30s and 40s. And so you'd always see some sort of good action war picture on Battleground. And one day, for some reason, I just happened to be going through my living room and the TV was on, and why I wasn't playing outside on this particular day, I don't know, but I wasn't, and William Wellman's Beaugest was on, and it was about halfway over. I since came to learn that it was almost exactly midway through the film when I came upon it, but it was immediately riveting to me. I don't know exactly what it was about it, but I just thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen, and so I was just transfixed by it. And this, of course, being commercial television, during one of the commercials, my mother came walking through, and I must have said something like, "This is great. This is the greatest thing I've ever seen." And she said, "Oh, I think there's a book about that." And so the next day, I went into the school library and went up to my librarian, Miss Laval, and said, "Is there a book called Beaugest?" And she said, "Yes, there is. We have it." And she led me over to it. And not only was it a book called Beaugest, the novel, by Percival Christopher Wren, but this one had movie stills illustrating it. And it was what I later found out was called a photoplay edition. But I realized right off the bat that this was not the movie I'd seen, that it was a movie about Beau Geste, but it was not the movie I'd seen. But it was an earlier silent version with Ronald Colman. And so I read the novel, loved the novel, and immediately started scouring the bigger library in a bigger town close by where we lived, Spartanburg, South Carolina, and started looking for books on silent movies for no other reason at all than to find something else about Beau Geste, maybe to find another picture from Beau Geste. And the very first film book I ever bought was just about that time. It was called Immortals of the Screen, and it was just short biographies and pictures of some of the great silent film stars, and some just of the players, just not the big stars, but just the others. And this was a whole new world to me, and I just devoured it. I loved it, and read this book, looked at all these pictures, had never seen most of these people in anything. And a few of them, I recognized them from being on TV later in life, like Zazu Pitts and people like that who would have shown up on sitcoms in the 50s and 60s, but certainly had never seen any of the films. And then I found out that the Spartanburg Public Library had 8mm films from Black Hawk, a great film distributing company of home movies that had a lot of silent movies and comedy shorts, Laurel and Hardy and Chaplin and so forth. And there at the Spartanburg Public Library, there were all these Black Hawk films on 8mm film, and I could just check them out for free and take them home and show them on our 8mm projector at home. It was incredible. It was wonderful. So I must admit, I've found nobody else in my school who was the slightest bit interested in any of this stuff. But I loved watching Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin and even the Keystone Cops, which I didn't find funny at all and still don't, as in most of the Max Sennett films. I don't find them at all funny. But I found them just interesting for... It was like this glimpse into the past, and I don't know why, but I was riveted by this. And just seeing the cars and seeing the homes and seeing how people dressed and how they behaved and all of that was so interesting to me. And I realized that I didn't have that in common with much of anybody that I knew. My grandmother, who was born in the 1880s and died in the early 70s, would tell me stories about her childhood, and they always just fascinated me. And I don't think any of my other cousins or my friends had much interest in listening to her talk about that stuff. But to me, just having her describe this other world, this somehow foreign world, was so... deeply embedding itself into my brain. I remember later on, I read L.P. Hartley's book, The Go-Between, and it begins with the passage, "The past is a foreign country, they do things differently there." And that passage immediately resonated with me because that's always how I had seen it. For some reason, I'd always seen the past as being this physical place that you could go to if you could just figure out how to what vehicle to board to get to it. And little by little, I realized that the movies were that vehicle, that we literally could see the world, and now we can see the world from 110, 115 years ago, and see people in motion, see actual moving pictures of the world from over a century ago. We're the only beings in the history of the universe who've ever been able to do this. And whenever I hear people dismissing old films as being quaint or dated or absurd or ridiculous or whatever they are, I just think these people are idiots. because this is the greatest miracle of our age, that we can actually look into this window through time and not distorted by imagination or as reading about the past is, because we always see things through our own prism, but to look at movies that show actually the way the world worked. It's amazing. It really is something so precious that I just get flummoxed when I see how many people don't value it at all. Not every film is great. Not every film is even good. But every film at least has the potential of showing us something special about its particular time and place. And it's really an amazing thing. There's something, there's some sort of inadvertent documentarianism about every film, because whether a filmmaker means to or not, and most of them, of course, never thought about it, they're shooting things that are depicting their time and place in some indelible way. And I think a lot of this stuff is completely accidental, but that doesn't make it any less precious. Here's an example. West Side Story, favorite movie of mine. When they were filming that in the Upper West Side of New York City, they did most of it here in Los Angeles, of course, but for the beginning scenes of that film, they're on location in New York City on the Upper West Side. And when they were filming that, which I believe was around 1960, 59 or 60, they had to delay the destruction of all these tenements in the West Side. They were going to be torn down to make Lincoln Center. And so there you see these scenes of the Jets and the Sharks dancing about the streets in, among all these old tenement buildings on the Upper West Side. Within months after the film was completed, all these buildings are gone, and Lincoln Center is being put up in their place. Now, a couple of years later, in 1964, I guess, 65, a movie adaptation of the play A Thousand Clowns is produced, and there's a scene, actually a scene that always annoys me because it seems to be so superfluous in so many ways, but a scene where the characters are just riding their bicycles around New York City. But there's a scene during that scene where they drive past Lincoln Center, which is then under construction. Then, a couple of years after that, Mel Brooks' The Producers has a scene at the fountain of Lincoln Center, and the fountain goes on and the lights go on and everything during this funny little scene where they, Gene Wilder and Zero Mostel, decide to do this shady business deal. And there's a pretty new Lincoln Center in all of its splendor right there, and it's completed. Now, the people who made West Side Story and A Thousand Clowns and The Producers never had any intention, never crossed any of their minds, I'm sure, that they were making this little documentary about the building of Lincoln Center. But they did, and there it is. And if you look at those three films, you'll see a kind of time lapse of this same situation, the same location, and as this landscape is changing here, and you see the landscape in the background of these films. And it's not background that was ever intended to be anything but background. But seen now, and seen through that particular prism, it becomes something else. This is the case in countless movies, especially movies shot on location, and especially movies shot on location in cities or in towns. A few years ago, I did a museum exhibit in South Carolina about the history of filmmaking in the state. And there was a Herschel Gordon Lewis movie I found called Moonshine Mountain. And It was made in 1963, I believe, and just made in these little towns, not only in South Carolina, but just across the border in North Carolina. And when I watched that film, every time I did, when I was preparing for this documentary and when I was writing about the subject, I watched the film two or three times. A nice fellow in one of the towns where it was made took me out to where the main house had been, but which is now just a blank spot in the woods. But the town itself is shown, and it's a color film. And there it is. It's, you know, there's the plot going on, and it's not very good acting, and it's not very good plot, and it's not a very good movie. But for those moments, there's this town in 1963, and there are the cars, and all the people in the background are not extras. They're just the people who live there, who happen to be in range of the camera at the time. And when they walk into a little hotel lobby, that's the actual hotel, and that's the actual lobby, and there they are. And it changes from what was this minimalist little kind of crime movie slash comedy. It never quite makes up its mind what it is, but it changes from just being that, this forgettable little movie, to in some ways being this document of a time and place. And that's something incredibly special. So that's what the conversations and the commentary track are going to be about. Not only the films themselves and what they are as artistic entities, but what they are as cultural artifacts, what they are about, what they show us about the world, and what they show us about the way people were, and what they considered to be important, and what their mores were, and what their morals were, and their behaviors, what they thought was funny, what they thought was sad, what they thought was important. Whenever I hear somebody talk about a film and they talk down to it a little bit and they say, "Oh, it was dated," I think the fact that it was dated is kind of one of the most important things about it, one of the things that I find most valuable about it, because that just means that it shows the time and it shows the place. It shows the way people wore their hair, the kind of clothes they wore. And because the way we wear our hair, if any, and the clothes that we wear are different than they were then, it doesn't make that era ridiculous. It doesn't mean that the entire history of the world has been this absurdity that's only leading up to a perfect now. Every era has been fine. Every era has been just itself. And the more that a movie depicts that, the more valuable it becomes in many ways. And so I want this podcast to be about things like that. I also wanted to be about the people who made these movies, the great personalities, the directors and producers and the actors. I hope they will open your eyes to some films that you've never seen. I hope that the podcast will be informative, but more than that, I hope they're fun. And more than that, I hope they're inspirational, and I don't mean in a sappy way, but they'll just inspire you to open your horizons to other to other possibilities, to check out things that you've never seen. But now that we have better access to so many of these things than we ever had before, I said earlier that it was like my generation's version of walking through the 6 feet of snow to school. But, gosh, I remember when I was in Boston in the mid-70s, and after this chance screening of Beaugest when I was 12, I was never able to see it again. And I was in Boston, and I saw in the New Yorker that it was going to be playing at the Theater 80 St. Mark's in New York City. And I borrowed a car from one of my roommates, and I drove 4 hours plus to New York City went in, watched Beau Geste, got back in the car, and drove 4 hours back to Boston, and was happy to have been able to do it. And to think that today it's so easy to just to get that DVD or to even stream it on Netflix, or maybe it'll just show up on TV or something. It's miraculous, but I guess in the other way, it's the things that we really have to fight for and struggle for and strive for gain more value to us, and maybe that's why these things embedded themselves so deeply in my brain and in the brains of the other people who have devoted their lives to studying these films and to the enjoyment of these films. And so I hope that you're among those, and if you're not, I hope that the commentary track will open some of these doors to you and provide some information and provide some inspiration and some leads to seeing some things that you will then find wonderful and maybe even indispensable. I'm really looking forward to this, and I hope you'll join me for, I think, what promises to be a really fascinating journey. And most of all, I just hope it's going to be fun for everybody. I can tell you that from all the interviews I've done so far, it's been great fun for me. I hope you'll join me on this. We'll see you next week. And don't worry, we're going to fix this in post.